This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's a hot afternoon in Ijo Selangor, which is a one-hour drive's journey from Kuala Lumpur. It's a dry and dusty day, made worse by the construction of new housing in what used to be a quiet village. What was once quaint thatched roof huts have given way to development, but there's one curiosity that has remained there after all these years. In one of the houses, a British gentleman can often be seen pottering around, far from the bright lights and the expat lifestyle commonly seen in the capital. This man is former Malay Mail roving correspondent Peter Moss, whose published memoirs recount an amazing range of experiences, including dropping allowance money onto rubber plantations and tin mines, spending nights in the long houses in the jungle, accompanying Commonwealth troops to hunt for terrorists, and flying recon patrols seeking guerrilla camps. I'm Nadia Aziz, and you're listening to the seventh episode in our new series on heritage and culture and all things Malaysian. Born into an Anglo-Indian railway community in 1935, Peter Moss left India shortly before the country's independence in 1947 and spent the next decade acquiring an English education, a foundation in journalism, and a restless desire to head back to the East.
I had read about Malaya. I was a great fan of Hugh Clifford, the author who later became governor in Singapore. I'd read James Conrad's books. And of course, all of them were set in this part of the world. And even The Emergency, I used to follow the stories of The Emergency and envy the people who were posted out here. So when I got the chance, I was delighted to come back.
So Malaya to you was the land of adventure.
Very much, yeah. The Golden Chersonese, as Isabella Bird called it, you know, the lady who travelled up and down the length of the peninsula on elephants.
And this adventure came in the form of a job with the Malay Mail.
Yes.
But when you first came to Malaya, you hadn't even gotten a reply from the newspaper, isn't that correct?
That's right. I had to deceive the immigration officers who came on board the ship at Penang. I lied to them, to be quite honest. I had written to the Malay Mail before I left, but I never got a reply. So when I arrived in Penang and the immigration officers came on board and they said, what was my reason for coming to Malaya? I said I had a job and I was surprised that they hadn't heard from my employer in the Malay Mail. And they said, no, we've got no such letter. But they were prepared to believe me and they gave me 2 weeks grace to actually come down to KL and gain the proof that I was, in fact, offered a job. So my uncle and aunt drove me down to the Malay Mail office in KL, where I met the editor, Martin Hutton, lovely guy, and said, I wrote to you before leaving England, but I never got a reply. And he said, that's correct. We get crank letters from all sorts of people who want to come out here, and we weren't sure whether yours was a genuine indication of a desire to work. To be honest, we don't have a slot available at the moment. But he was prepared to test me on my writing skills, which had been acquired on a local newspaper back in England. So I asked him what he'd like me to write about, and he was intrigued by the story of my trip out overland. So I wrote 3 feature page articles about my adventures on the journey. And he published all of them and gave me the job, just like that, on the basis of my... He thought I could write adequately, but he realized I loved adventure. So he was happy to give me a taste of writing as their roving reporter. I just fell on my feet. I was so lucky. I just kind of bluffed my way into the country, and then from there on, it just took off. I fell in love with Malaya because it was so cosmopolitan, it was so multiracial, anything goes, you know, open house everywhere, it depends. You have Malay, Chinese, Indian friends who would invite you over. I loved it.
You arrived here in 1957, but you missed the chance to witness the Merdeka Declaration itself.
I did, yes. Because of the fact that I left on Merdeka Day from London, Victoria Coach Station, in a funny old London to Margate type bus, which attracted a lot of attention because it was even then the oldest bus in the Victoria Coach Station. And it had this map down the side of the bus showing the route from London to India with the legend, the Indiaman. Everyone else was going to Eastbourne or Brighton or Margate. And we were attracting quite a bit of attention. Like people were coming over and saying, are you really going to go to India in this thing? And we said, yes, we hope so. Can I book a seat? And we said, no, I'm afraid all the seats are taken, which they were by then. So yes, that was how I missed Merdeka. But fortunately, I got to know most of the people who were responsible for Tunku Abdul Rahman, who I was very fond of. I used to interview him. Tun Razak. Got to know most of the cabinet in its day. It was a very good cabinet. They were very bright people. Tan Siew Sin, I think, was the finance minister from Malacca. Very smart guy, really. Very impressive bunch of people, yeah. And I used to go to the parliament sessions and report on the proceedings. I remember when Malaya wanted to send an army contingent to join the UN force in the Congo because of the Congo situation. Tunku had to explain the rationale behind it. And every time he mentioned the name of the man we were going to help, Mobutu, the whole of the chamber burst into laughter. Because I suppose it sounded like Mobutu or something, I don't know. That was very strange. And dear old Tunku, yeah.
Why did you want to head east so badly?
I had been very disappointed doing my 2-year obligatory national service, which in those days were required of everybody reaching the age of 18. And I still regard it as an extremely good system. I mean, I wish they reintroduce it because it would cure a lot of the problems that youngsters have these days, drunkenness and loutish behavior. So for 2 years, I was buried in a military camp at Sidcup in Kent in the Royal Army Pay Corps. The last thing I wanted to do was to be in the Royal Army Pay Corps. I had no experience of accounting, but the military works that way. They ask you what you'd like to do, and then give you the very opposite of what to do. So I'd said I wanted to be in the tank regiment. I wanted to be in Malaya. I actually wanted to be fighting in the Malayan emergency. But no, I was deprived of that. And for 2 years, I was stuck in England. I had a fantastic time because I still treasure my national service days. But as soon as I was liberated, I wanted to get back east again. And as I say, this opportunity occurred in 1957 to catch a bus back to India, so I jumped at it. My military relatives, my uncle and aunt, were living in a bubble world. They were living in this military cantonment and being shunted from one post to another. They never actually got to know the countries they were posted in. They would meet other military personnel, but really they were stuck in these bubbles. And I said, I'm not going to live in this bubble world. I want to get to grips with this country, you know. So I escaped from the bubble and had a whale of a time.
Where was this bubble? Was it Kuala Lumpur?
Yeah, there was this military circle. We used to meet at the Selangor Club and, you know, you'd always end up with the same quasi-military crowd. They weren't even mingling with planters and the other expat population. They were just mixing with military types. You'd hear some hilarious stories from time to time. I remember one of our neighbors in Ritchie Road was a major or something, one of the regiments, and their quarter was invaded by an Orang Minyak, who would actually slide through the grill or something, covered in oil. And this guy woke up to realize this prowler in the house. So he tackled him. But this guy, the major, slept naked. And this Orang Minyak was so slippery, he couldn't hold on to him. He ended up trying to chase this guy down the drive until he realized that although he was covered in oil himself, he was dark naked himself and liable to be mistaken for an Orang Minyak. So he beat a hasty retreat back to the house. They never did catch the Orang Minyak.
So you didn't quite agree with the expat military crowd.
I thought they had very narrow horizons, and I wanted to learn Malay. I wanted to learn about the country. And I found an opportunity when I met a guy from this village. It was Kampong Ijo. It really was a village in those days. It was just a thatched huts with rubber trees and coffee plantations. And he was a neighbor of ours, and he knew my houseboy, our houseboy. I was sharing a flat in Shuyok Road with a chap called Jerry Jackson. And this houseboy came to us with rave reviews from previous employees, one of whom described him as the perfect Jeeves. So I thought, he sounds promising. And it turned out he was one of the key figures in Anthony Burgess's first Malayan novel, Time for a Tiger, because Hairuddin was the houseboy who's a bit of a pondan. He likes to go off down to the town and the joget halls at night and sort of play the limp wrist playboy. He was quite a character. He was a fantastic houseboy. He loved our house. He loved everything in it, and he was meticulous about keeping it clean. And for him, the only drawback was the fact that we were living in the house. So we were an impediment to what he regarded as his house. He didn't take to us very much. He was a fantastic cook, too. But being a Muslim, he didn't like cooking pork, quite naturally. And my partner, Jerry Jackson, loved bacon, and he couldn't live without bacon. So he insisted on having bacon every morning. Hairuddin hated this procedure because he had these long forceps to lift the rashers of bacon into a distant frying pan. And now and then, the fat from the frying pan would spit back at him and he'd scream and shout, Babi Chilaka, and swear and curse and express his anger. We would always tell him he was out of sorts because he made it quite apparent that he was having a bad day again. But we actually hired him because his predecessor was a Malay armor who turned our house into a public laundry when we weren't there. So there we were, operating this damn laundry. And our housekeeper, the Malay lady who was running the show, came up to Jerry with a basket saying, "We always launder your clothes first." Well, that was it. We sent them on their way, and then we had to replace them. And of course, Hairuddin was the perfect choice.
You've been listening to episode 7 of the first season of Malaysiana on heritage, culture, and all things Malaysian. Stay tuned as veteran journalist Peter Moss tells us the story of how he made the sleepy village of Ijo his home. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to episode 7 of the first season of Malaysiana with me, Nadia Aziz. We're speaking to veteran journalist Peter Moss, who was a roving correspondent with the Malay Mail and NST in the decade after Merdeka.
Next door was a lovely doctor called Dr. Kok, K-O-K. And he couldn't understand why he kept losing his brass nameplates. Every time he'd put an expensive nameplate up, it would be stolen by British troops souveniring this nameplate, because the nameplate would say Dr. Kok too fat, you know. And of course, it was irresistible. So we suggested that he name himself Dr. T.F. Kok. He compromised. He was a good neighbor.
Tell me what Kuala Lumpur was like back then.
Oh, lovely. It was more like a very big village. You tended to get to know everybody. And you had to watch your reputation. You'd become notorious very quickly, which I'm sure I did. I'm sure that I earned this reputation of being a pretty notorious playboy. But it was lovely. I enjoyed it immensely. I miss it very much, because it has nothing to do with today's KL. I'm sure that if I had never been to KL before and I'd just arrived, I would love KL as it is now. But I can't get the old city out of my mind. So I really am not interested. I'm too old for the sort of things I used to do back in the 60s. And I avoid KL. I love to live here in the Kampong.
How did you end up in Ijo? What made you move from KL to Ijo? That's quite a distance.
Because this Javanese called Mokti, Mokti bin Mat Sahit, was living here, and he was a neighbor of ours in Chuyok Road. And he was a friend of our cook boy, Khairuddin. And I liked him because he was a very egalitarian guy. He was one of these people who had absolutely no respect for anyone thinking they were of any greater status than himself. And instead of calling me Tuan or Mister or Master, he would call me Peter. So I quite liked that egalitarian attitude, you know. And I felt I was accepted. So he brought me here to meet his family. Lovely old father who was one of the senior hajis in the mosque across the road. It was just a little suel in those days. And I did a deal with Mokti. I was going to teach him English in exchange for him teaching me Malay. I think he learnt English far quicker than I learnt Malay, but whatever little Malay I learnt from him. And then one day, within about 2 years of first meeting him, he was suddenly missing from my life. He never came to the house. And I wondered what had happened to him, because he used to phone or at least keep in touch. So I went to the place where he was working as a driver with an architectural firm. And I learned that he was on the point of death. He'd been admitted to the old Circular Road Hospital with a kidney infection, which was being treated with antibiotics. It wasn't a very serious infection unless it was neglected. The trouble is, his parents didn't trust Western medicine. So they came one night and abducted him from the hospital, brought him back to the Kampong to be treated by a BOMO. And weeks had gone by, and he was rapidly deteriorating because he wasn't getting the attention he needed. And this colleague told me, yes, he's dying. His parents took him away back to the Kampong. So thank God I remembered my way here along Route 54. I dashed out. I remember where the house was. I parked the car. I rushed through the rubber trees, and there was this house, this wooden hut, which had become, you know, a kind of deathbed scene. The whole family was assembled. They were expecting him to die at any moment. And the Burma was casting stones and doing his mumbo-jumbo thing. And I was furious. I was just so angry. I just barged through the whole lot of them and sort of lifted him up. He was just like a skeleton. And I said, I'm not having this. I'm taking him back to hospital. So I marched out of the house through the rubber trees, back to the car, followed by all of his family wondering what the hell I was doing, including his parents and his wife. And his son wasn't born at that stage. I took him back to hospital, and he recovered fairly rapidly, thanks to normal antibiotics. And the next time I came to the kampong with Mokti, who was by then fit again, his father was so grateful to me for saving his son's life that he said, please look after my son for the rest of your life. So I thought, oh, okay. So that became a kind of commitment. And when I went to Hong Kong in 1965, I took him and his wife and his two young kids with me. So we spent the next 45 years in Hong Kong, where he learned Cantonese much better than I did. His wife, Sarah, who still lives next door, went to work in a factory and enjoyed a degree of freedom she could never have enjoyed in the kampong. And the two boys went to an English school and, I'm afraid, neglected their native language, spoke English with all their friends were English. In fact, Musli's closest friend was an Israeli Jew from the island school. Musli went to his bar mitzvah ceremony in the synagogue in Hong Kong. It was that kind of place, you know, very free and easy. So when we left Hong Kong in 2010, I'd retired from the government by then, and I'd planned to settle in Hong Kong, but my retirement jobs faded out one by one. I was the big crash of 2007. Deprived me of the last of the steady retainer fees I was getting. And I realized that I couldn't live on the meager proceeds from my writing unless I had some kind of steady income. So I decided Hong Kong had become too expensive a place to live. I sold my house for about $1 million. And moved here. And this house was a lot cheaper to build. In fact, it was already built back in 93. Mokti and I shared the cost of, I built the floor above, and this was the family floor. So we ended up back where we'd started. Sadly, he died last year. Just after Harry Raya, and he was buried in the cemetery here. The family all know me because I've seen them all grow up, you know, and they all call me uncle. They're very protective, and I feel very much at home here. But alas, because I can't qualify for Malaysia My Second Home status, I have to keep leaving at the end of every 3 months to go back to Hong Kong or to the Philippines, where I have another home with another family. So I circulate.
If you missed the full interview with veteran journalist Peter Moss, download the podcast at www.bfm.my. Join us next Sunday at noon for part two of the conversation. You've been listening to Malaysiana with me, Nadia Aziz, on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.